Today, words like Columbine, Newtown, Orlando, and more recently Dallas, serve as touchstones for a sense of shared tragedy. They're part of our public memory. But what do we remember of the event that started this chapter 50 years ago?
I think at the time we figured it was a random event that would never occur again.
I mean, we were crying. Oh my gosh.
Nobody could comprehend or conceive this happening.
It's a new era. No plans. It was a moment in which our innocence was lost.
On August 1st, 1966, the day a sniper climbed to the top of the University of Texas Tower, opening fire on an unsuspecting public below, no one had any way to make sense of it. An event so unthinkable at the time, many of those who lived through it are only starting to share their stories now. From PRI, Public Radio International, I'm David Brown, and you're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard, Out of the Blue, 50 years after the Texas Tower shooting. From PRI, Public Radio International, you're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard, Out of the Blue, 50 years after the Texas Tower shooting. I'm David Brown. Where are we exactly? Inside the base of this grand university tower, an ornate architectural icon that's cast such a long shadow over Texas, over history. You don't expect this to be the way inside. A long, narrow hallway of blue concrete block, empty under the dim fluorescent light. The walk-through metal detector doesn't seem to be working. And if it were, there's nothing more than a Coke machine guarding the elevator doors. Everything seems cramped, the ceilings severe and low, and the ride to the 27th floor as unceremonial and unremarkable as the name of this place, the main building. The elevator stops before you get to the top, a winding staircase, then a modest reception area, where it used to be once upon a time. Visitors checked in, wrote their names in a book, and then walk out to this, an observation deck offering what was once the grandest view of the capital city of Texas. You can still see the pockmarks left by all those bullets. Looks like the concrete patches didn't hold to the limestone. The walkway where on August 1st, 1966, police finally cornered the gunman after 96 minutes, after he'd shot more than 40 people and killed 16. And there's the spot in the northwest corner where Charles Whitman's body lay crumpled after his massacre. But there's nothing else here, just the whip of a hot summer wind and the sound of the passing time. What did we expect to find up here? 50 years later, what are we looking for? What was he thinking? Why did it happen? What was the purpose? What does it mean? And as you look out above all these people, too high to see their faces, too removed to hear their voices, well, that's when it hits you. After all these years trying to understand the shooter and his motives, maybe we've forgotten what we came here for. If we're really trying to attach some meaning to what happened, maybe we've been looking in the wrong place. After all these years of looking up at the tower, maybe we need to look around.
One, two, three. Austin
on August 1st. Blue sky, wispy clouds, beautiful day, hotter than hell.
Austin was small and beautiful. It was already kind of weird, I guess you'd say. The food was already good. The music was already great. And it was just some of the best years of my life.
Well, Janis Joplin was a classmate of mine. I didn't know her. But she sat on the Union steps and strummed her guitar and sang. Pretty much a fixture there in front of the Union. And they were not hippies. They were beatniks in those days.
We were all used to, just whenever we pleased, running up to the 27th floor of the tower. Well, not literally running, but getting on the elevator and going up there to show your relatives, friends, parents, whatever, the view of the campus, and never thinking twice about it.
The best thing about being in the tower itself is that you could see everywhere. Occasionally, I would go into our library, and from the library, you could see the airport and see the planes taking off and landing. I mean, you could just see forever.
One of the ways that we sometimes entertained ourselves was at lunchtime, we would go into the University of Texas Tower and take the elevator up and walk that walkway that was up at the top, because it went all the way around. There were four corners to it. And you could kind of push yourself up with your hands and look over to see all the way around in a 360-degree cycle the ground below.
8 miles high, and when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known.
Austin was a considerably different place back then than it is now. There were only 250,000-300,000 people. There wasn't any industry other than the state government and the university, so almost everybody left after they finished their final degree. Martin Luther King hadn't died yet, so the street hadn't been named after him. There were no co-ed dorms. Nobody could even have conceived of a co-ed dorm at that point in time. The women had curfews on the weekend, or every night.
I tell you what, we were a lot more conservative than the 21-year-olds now. You know, we wore dresses all the time, and shoot, we wore heels and suits to football games. You know, we had teased up hair and buttoned down shirts, kind of like they're wearing today, madras skirts, that type of thing.
Yeah, we grew up in probably the best of times. We had rock and roll and muscle cars and hot rods. I mean, what else could you want in life?
You know, a coming of age. It was, you know, it's. I remember you go out and ride around and drink beers, and it was very exciting and new. Back then, it was when you go fill up your car to get at a gasoline pump, it would ding every time a dollar went by. Scarber's department store downtown had an elevator that was operated by an old black gentleman. That was sit on a stool in the elevator. I remember in 1965, the summer of 65, the American Nazi Party had a march down Congress Avenue where they were handing out free Back to Africa tickets to any black person they could see.
I was an African American student. One of the first things that we had to deal with as a statistic were that we, as a collective mass of students, were less than 1%.
It was very, in a very tacit, quiet sense, very segregated back then.
I had a good friend as part of the international student body from Costa Rica. His name was Ruben, or Ruben. And he happened to be black. And I remember he and I went to get a haircut one time and to a place that's just right across the drag. And the person wouldn't cut his hair.
We were a political hotbed at that point, and also on our campus was an organization called SDS, Students for Democratic Society, for a Democratic Society. And they were the ones that were fooling around with plastic explosives and planning to blow up draft boards, because at that time there was the draft.
People get ready, have a train a car.
We did have issues on campus, protests against the Vietnam War, and I felt so brave that I got to have a voice as to my opinion, because prior to coming to Texas, I guess I thought whatever I was told to think. I mean, I certainly had never had my own opinions about everything, so Texas was very liberating.
My friend Sandra Wilson and I decided to go to a movie downtown in Austin at the Paramount Theater. So I guess we finished with the movie about 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night and drove out west part of town to Mount Bonnell, walked up to the top of the mountain, and really engaged in something of a political discussion on political issues. There was a lot of stuff going on with demonstrations against wars, etc. And a part of the discussion centered around the activities of police and all these demonstrations. And Sanders' discussion was that maybe we don't need the police here. Maybe the people can take care of this. And so I remarked to Sandra, said, Sandra, you know, I think there's situations where the people can't completely take care of the situation. What if somebody were to randomly start shooting people? Wouldn't we need the police then to help out? 12 hours later, it happened.
We had guns on campus when I was going here. I had my guns. I had my shotguns in my dorm, and I had them in my apartment because we went hunting. I mean, we would go hunting in the afternoon. We'd go out East Austin. There's a lake, a small lake. You could actually, during season, go dove hunting, which we did. So most people had guns. They had guns in the dorm. They had guns in their apartments. You know, that was not anything unusual.
In my senior year, spring of my senior year, I took a political history class in the architecture building. I came early for class. I sat in a windowsill. In the windowsill to my left was Charles Whitman, and he talked to some of his hangers-on and other people, and he was pretty vocal about his love of guns, his love of killing, his love of being a bad boy. And I thought he was a dangerous person even when I encountered him at that time. He seemed to have two or three people who liked to egg him on, talk to him about being a sniper, talk to him about being in the Marines, talk to him about Vietnam, and he bragged about if he were there, he would how many people he would kill and things of that sort.
When he first got to Austin in September of 1961, he told a friend on the balcony of the Goodall Wooten dorm, while they were looking at the tower, he said, you know, a guy could go up there with a deer rifle and kill people for as long as he wanted, and he could hold off an army if he wanted to. Now, he said that 5 years before he did it.
I call him Charlie Fingernails because every time I saw him alone, he was chewing his fingernails. And it was both disgusting and frightening. It just hurt me even to look at it.
At about 11:35 on the morning of August 1st, 1966, a burly man with a flat-top haircut, dressed as a custodian, threw a footlocker onto a hand truck and started hauling it to the top of the University of Texas Tower. As he did, a young couple took in the view of Austin from the tower's observation deck. It was a beautiful, clear day, close to 100 degrees, softened by the breeze at the top of the clock tower. The two couldn't have possibly known what they would encounter when they decided to leave that day, opening the door to return to the reception area and to a world forever changed. I'm David Brown, and you're listening to Out of the Blue, 50 years after the Texas Tower shooting, from PRI, Public Radio International. We'll continue in just a moment. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a policyholder-owned workers' comp provider helping keep businesses strong by preventing workplace accidents. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, you're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard, Out of the Blue, 50 years after the Texas Tower shooting. I'm David Brown. In the 5 decades since the morning of August 1st, 1966, remarkably little has been written about an incident that hindsight would reveal to be a starting point for a new chapter in the public life of America. For years, the questions about this event centered on the motivations, the reason why a shooter would randomly open fire on strangers. The idea itself so inconceivable that the stories of those who were there, the experiences of the people affected, went largely untold until now. And in the nearly 100 interviews conducted 50 years later for this observance, what comes through is how much we've taken for granted, not just then, but now, and how on that morning, so much really did change, seemingly from out of the blue.
It was another Monday morning in Austin, Texas. Nothing different, nothing unique. It was hotter than hell.
It would get to 100 degrees outside before the University of Texas tower bells chimed 12 times. In an era when people carried transistor radios like people carry cell phones today, nearly everyone in the Texas capital city knew the voice of Neil Speltz. He was a young news reporter at a local radio station.
August 1st, it was already hot when the sun came up, and by the time noon rolled around, it was blistering hot in Austin. Summer school was underway on campus. There weren't that many students in summer school at that point, but they were going to classes. The work life went on. There was no legislative session underway. It was just kind of every day in Austin, Texas, with nothing unique about it, nothing unusual.
Charles Whitman's killing spree had already started before he reached the top of the stairs of the Texas Tower. No one knew he'd already secretly killed his wife and mother, or that at the top, in the reception area to the observation deck, he'd split the skull of the receptionist with the butt of his rifle, dragging her behind a couch. But the man who was about to open fire on the campus of the University of Texas didn't know that someone was out on the observation deck, two people actually. Cheryl Botts and Don Walden had just finished taking in the spectacular view from up there, and they returned to the reception area, their eyes still adjusting to the dark light inside.
We finally decided to go back in. We went back inside, and Whitman was standing there. He was wearing sort of a gray coveralls, I guess.
The first thing we saw when we walked into the reception area was that the receptionist was not at her desk. And I rationalized in my mind, she's probably gone to lunch. As we started walking in, there was a dark stain, a dark swath across the floor. And my first thought was varnish. And I thought, they're going to varnish the floor in the middle of the day when people are here. This makes no sense. But I pointed it out to Don. We both stepped over it, which we found out later was the receptionist's blood, where he had dragged her body across the room. Whitman was standing there, and he turned around to face us, and he had a rifle in each hand. Well, we had come into the reception room talking and visiting, stepped over the stain, looked over there and saw him, and I smiled and said hello, and he smiled and said, hi, how are you?
I thought it was lunchtime, and he was dressed in workman's stuff. And I thought he was up there to shoot pigeons. And he was smiling a lot, big smile.
Don almost asked him if he was going to go out and shoot pigeons. Fortunately, he did not. That probably would not have been wise. Everybody always says you didn't think anything funny about him having two rifles. This was 1966. Nothing like this had ever happened before. The boys in my class at school had gun racks in their pickups, and guns were hanging on the gun racks in the school parking lot with the trucks unlocked. You know what I'm saying? It was a different time. And I might have wondered if I had stopped and looked and But we didn't. We were preoccupied, and we just kept going. And that probably saved our lives. I really believe that firmly.
And then we went on down. For those of you who don't know how it is, there's a reception area. There's a stairway going down to the elevators. And he had barricaded part of that stairway. He'd taken some chairs and piled them up down there. We went down, got on the elevator.
We decided to try going down to basement level and going out the back door. And then we would leave. So we got to the back door, and when Don opened the back door. Somebody about 20 feet in front of us got shot and fell. And he said, "We are not leaving," and he closed the door.
I kept hearing what sounded like a lumber dropping. It was like a clapping sound as it came through the buildings, and it sounded like it was a building or two over, and someone was maybe had a crane and was dropping some lumber on the ground.
At 11:45, it was still routine. 11:45 a.m., it was routine in the newsroom. Routine around the campus. Routine all over the city. And then in our newsroom, a police radio crackled out.
"We have a shooting or gunshots at the University Tower."
Okay, that's fairly routine. Police radio says something like that. And then the police radio shortly thereafter, I mean within seconds.
222-219. "What did he say he had?
Is he a gunshot? I heard a gunshot, or he had a shooting, one or the other, at the University Tower."
And I turned to Phil Miller, who was our sports guy, who was in getting ready for his evening sportscast. I said, "Phil, can you go? I just turned over my shoulder. Can you check that out, see what it is? I'm getting ready to go on the air here on radio." And I was putting the noon newscast together. He said, "Yeah, I'll tell you what, Neil, I'm going to lunch. I'll just hop in my car and I'll drive out there. And if there's anything to it, I'll call you on the phone."
Someone rushed into the building and said, "There's someone shooting from the tower. Get away from the windows. Get down." And so we did.
I stood up and thought, Could that be shots? I walked out of the front door of the architecture building onto the West Mall, and I looked out on the main mall, and I saw several bodies or people down. And then it became real to me, and I ran back to the architecture building, into the office, and told the secretary, "Call the police, somebody's shooting people." She did, and was told they were aware of it and on their way.
I mean, our station was just 3 or 4 blocks south of the campus. I said, "Damn, we got to have somebody there. So I jumped into another mobile unit, another Red Rover mobile unit, and drove to the campus.
I noticed something strange because there was a bicycle that was in the street, lying in the street. And I thought, what is that bicycle doing in the street? And somebody said, "Why don't you get it?" So I go walking towards the bicycle to pull it out of the street, and I'm almost to the edge of the curb when I notice that the bicycle is covered with blood.
We were riding along in the car and just listening to music, and they broke into that broadcast to announce that at the University of Texas in Austin, some guy was on the roof shooting and killing people.
"This is Neil Spelson, Red Rover, on the University of Texas campus. This is a warning to the citizens of Austin. Stay away from the university area. Traffic is now converging on this area, and there is a sniper on the university tower firing at will. Several persons have been injured. We have no reports on whether there are any fatalities, but we do know a boy riding a bicycle has been shot and seriously wounded. There has been a report of a policeman that has been shot."
Nobody could comprehend or conceive this happening, therefore there were no plans to counteract something like this.
Because, you know, there's no reference point. There's no, "Oh, this is like such and such." There's just nothing there.
"Another shot was just fired. The sniper fired another shot more or less in our direction, and there was a battery of gunfire from the police back at him. This is another shot that's fired about 6 minutes after the last report. Another shot. The sniper just fired another shot, apparently more or less in our direction. It did not hit nearby. Another shot. The sniper fired three quick successive shots. Apparently in the length of time it takes to cocked the weapon and then another shot. He just fired another shot, and this time
people were screaming and shouting, "Watch out! Get out! Get out of the way! Somebody's shooting! Tell that person to get down! Be careful! Someone's hurt. Go. Can anyone help them?" And so I'm broadcasting, starting my broadcast, hearing this sort of thing. When I say all hell broke loose, it really did all around the campus.
Another shot. There are two different kinds of shots. Apparently, police are returning the fire now, which means there's a danger of ricocheting bullets off the university tower.
They just weren't prepared for that kind of event. You know, nobody knew what to do. They didn't have any SWAT teams. It was kind of like the Wild West. You know, it was everybody for himself.
It's still, a lot of that is very, very vivid, those feelings. It was like disbelief everywhere.
And I remember standing there with others and having this feeling of rage and just saying out loud, "Somebody shoot him."
We'd see people fall, and we couldn't warn them. We'd see people fall, and then we'd hear the gun, and they couldn't hear us. And it was frustrating.
Looking out the window on the mall, there were a number of people laying around, some of them quite still and some of them moving somewhat. We could still hear the pops and see puffs of smoke coming from up on the tower. And
I mean, the first thing I remember seeing were those victims laying on the mall. One was on the grass and there were two on the main mall. And you could tell by their positions and how they were laying that unfortunately, they probably were not alive.
Some of the windows in our building were shot out, so we could hear the windows crashing. I mean, we were crying. The people out in the hall were like, "Oh my gosh." And we were, tears were running out of our eyes. I mean, it was such a sad thing.
You know, it's one of those things where it all seems like a dream while it's happening, and you're trying to figure out, is anyone else dreaming like I was?
Sometime around 5 minutes till noon, I don't know how much sooner. He wounded a young policeman standing beside me down pretty close down by the Bats Hall. And the one ambulance driver told me he carried in five people. So, and there's two or three laying out that evidently cannot be reached at the moment. Did you get, you were standing beside the policeman when he was shot? Yes. Do you know the policeman's name? No, I don't. Was there just one shot fired? Well, he opened fire on us when he saw the policeman with the shotgun converging. And he's evidently a quite accurate shot because placing the shots right on target. The policeman was walking. He shot him through the support near the statue of Jefferson Davis there at the on the mall.
We were being told over the radio that there were people wounded on the mall. And so I began walking up toward the south steps to the main mall. At one point in that walk, I heard kind of an explosion to my right. I looked over there and dust was flying from the limestone.
One of the things that made the very deepest impression on me, there's this guy, and I couldn't see his face well, but he was not fit to any way of reckoning. He was quite chubby, but he had on blue jeans and a white t-shirt, and he was running out onto the mall, grabbing some of the victims and dragging them back to the inner campus road there to safety, and there were some ambulances there waiting to provide help, coming to provide help. But I just thought his courage and his actions were just heroic.
This is a KLRN news bulletin. All Austin area residents are warned to stay away from the University of Texas campus area. The range of this man's rifle is not known.
There was a TV on and seemed to be just a still shot of the tower, just looking at it. Just a still shot of the tower. It seemed like there was no cameraman or anything behind it, like somebody abandoned the camera, and it was just a still shot of the tower that...
Ladies and gentlemen, we're attempting to bring you this live coverage of this sniper on the campus of the University of Texas. As you can understand, however, we're anxious about the cameraman getting out to be able to operate the cameras any better than they are.
And my aunt runs into the living room and turns on the TV, and she's frantic. And Aunt Eloisa, what's going on? What's going on? And she turned it on, and we were watching black and white live coverage of the UT Tower shooting. She goes, this is happening in Austin right now where your Tio Nuco is, where your Tio Nuco is. And of course, we got scared.
As you can tell from the position of this sniper, he has pretty clear control of the whole campus. Students and other people who are on campus can be seen crouching behind buildings anywhere within range of the main building. He has been up there at least 30 minutes now, I would estimate, and as we said, we have a report of five people lying on the ground in front of the building.
So we're looking out and trying to figure out what's going on, and pretty quickly, the door opens into the classroom, and here comes a John Wayne guy. He's got blue jeans on, boots, and a white T-shirt, and an elephant gun. That's the only way to describe it. He runs up, he elbows me out of the way, because my window was, I guess, positioned the best for what he did. He elbows me out of the way, he takes the butt of the gun, and he breaks it through the window. He starts hitting it to break the window. And he says, I want y'all to crawl like snakes out in the hallway, and you just sit out there till I tell you, till I give you other instructions. And then he fires away, boom, boom, boom. And then all of a sudden, you know, bullets come back our way, and I notice the glass break, and I can hear them zinging by.
On that day, I believe that the University of Texas student body was better armed than the Austin Police Department, which were equipped with pistols and the occasional shotgun. There was no SWAT teams. All those students with deer rifles that were firing at the tower, they took the law into their own hands and started firing back at the tower. It may have been one of the largest unofficial vigilante posses in American history.
All kinds of police and other people were shooting at him, and it was just like a world war going on outside our windows.
The men were not properly armed. The weapons were not right. They were not prepared for the onslaught. The best armed policemen from the Austin Police Department were officers who went back home, got their deer rifles, and then returned to the campus to fire back.
One of those officers, a skinny young 29-year-old, wasn't even on duty when he saw the news bulletin on TV as he was making his lunch. He grabbed his uniform and his .38 sidearm and raced down to the campus. The decisions he'd make over the next few minutes would save untold numbers of lives on a day that opened a new chapter in the public life of America, one we're still struggling to comprehend today. I'm David Brown, and you're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard. Out of the blue, 50 years after the Texas Tower shooting, from PRI, Public Radio International. We'll continue in just a moment. Stay with us. From PRI, Public Radio International, you're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard. Out of the blue, 50 years after the University of Texas Tower shooting. I'm David Brown. The very notion that on a blue summer day in a small American city, someone, anyone, could walk to the top of a university tower with an arsenal of weapons and indiscriminately shoot to kill strangers was so perverse, such a distortion of every assumption about humanity and society, that even the acknowledgement of the idea was as outlandish as it was profane, unthinkable, people would say. And yet, there, all around the University of Texas Tower on that afternoon of August 1, 1966, there were the bodies of the victims of that very nightmare. Among them, a pregnant woman who seemed to be very close to death. A 17-year-old freshman named John Fox decided he couldn't just watch the events unfold without doing something himself.
The girl that was always, I was always looking at, she was obviously very pregnant. And I could tell she was, alive because she was moving, her legs were moving. And I worried that if the shooter on the tower saw her, that she might be shot again. She was obviously wounded. The people around her looked dead. And the tower kept chiming every 15 minutes. And I would think, 15 more minutes they've been out there. 15 more minutes. I knew I might die when I ran out. I'd never been more scared. But the time came. James was right next to me, James Love. And James and I ran from there at the sidewalk of the Intercampus Drive across from the George Washington statue. We ran straight out to the people that were laying on the middle of the ball. Pardon me. I grabbed Claire's ankles, and James grabbed her wrist, and we picked her up.
Claire Wilson was a freshman, 8 months pregnant, writhing on the hot concrete. She'd already lost her baby but didn't know it, when Fox and another student, James Love, ran out to save her.
Oh, I was just so, so happy because I thought I was going to die there. And that he came up, you know, it was just like there was hope.
Started carrying her to safety, to the area behind the Jefferson Davis statue. It seemed like time passed very slow. I knew I might die when I went out. But it was intolerable to leave those people laying out there.
And I knew one of the guys, James Love, James Richard Love, had been in our anthropology class, and it was huge. And he had just probably a day or so before that been just totally reamed by the professor because he used the word like instead of as when he asked a question. And here, a couple of days later, he's brave enough to run out there and pick me up, you know?
I can feel a spot in my back right now. I remember thinking that if I was going to be shot, it would be in my backbone, right between my shoulder blades, and I can feel that spot right now. And as we went down the stairs, my glasses—I'm legally blind without my glasses—and they started sliding down my nose. They were big, like Buddy Holly-looking, thick glass lenses. And so James and I set Claire down on the sidewalk. I had to go back out from cover to find and pick up my glasses because everything was a blur. Since we set Claire down, four or five other students that were there under the Jefferson Davis statue picked up Claire and took her down to where the ambulance was.
And so I just, you know, I was just totally relieved and happy and felt like there was a chance now, you know, to live.
The Travis County Blood Bank has asked that anyone with the following blood types and who lives in the northeast part of town and can get safely to the blood bank at 2908 Interregional Boulevard to please come immediately.
I made a decision that I've thought it was right at the time, and still, though, I question it.
Again, newsman Neil Spells.
When our reporter at Breckenridge Hospital gathered up some names of the people who had been brought in, I told him to go ahead and read those names. I said, now normally we would have waited to notify the next of kin, but we didn't know who was dead or who was wounded. He didn't know at that point. He just said, these are the names we got jotted down as they came in. And so I said, go ahead and read those names. And he did.
The victims have been identified as Oscar Arriola, spelled A-R-R-O-Y-U-E-L-O, Sandra Wilson, Thomas Carr, Robert Hurd, Alex Hernandez, Argentina Espinosa, David Matson, Morris Holman, Karen Griffith, Emma Garcia, Harry Walsh, Billy Speed, Robert Boyer, Paul Sontag, Roy Schmidt.
Well, as it turns out, Paul Bolton, the semi-retired news director that I replaced, had come into the newsroom and was working, doing anything and everything that he could to help in the newsroom. And as the reporter read the names, Paul Bolton interrupted him at the end of the list of names and said, Joe.
This is Joe Roddy at Breckenridge Emergency Room.
Joe, hold it on. Hold just a minute. This is Paul over at the newsroom.
Yes.
Everyone is interested in that list of names. I think you have my grandson on there. Go over that list of names again, please.
Joe said, okay, Paul. And he went through and read the list again.
Paul Sontag.
And it was. It was not only his grandson, it was his namesake grandson, Paul Bolton Sontag.
It touched you because he was like the Walter Cronkite of Austin. He was everywhere, and when he was touched personally, it touched everybody, and it touched the heart of Austin.
When Joe finished reading the last of the names the second time, he said, is that what you wanted, Paul, or something like that to throw back to him? But you didn't hear Paul Bolton's voice. The next voice you heard on the air was Jay Hodgson. Jay was did a kids show on TV, but came into the newsroom to help. And Jay says, no, that's it. We've got it. Thank you. And he grabbed Paul Bolton and took him home.
Austin Police Officer Ray Martinez had zigzagged his way across the mall into the tower, where a civilian, Alan Crum, and fellow officer Houston McCoy had worked their way to the top, past the bodies of victims killed inside the stairwell, all the way to the observation deck.
Bullets keep coming up at us. I mean, they crack. You can hear the crack as they go over your head, and then they'd hit the tower, and dust would come down, rain down, and little particles of stone. I had to creep up to the protrusion and then look around the corner again. And when I looked, I saw the sniper, and he was in a sitting position with an M1 carbine pointing it at the southwest corner.
Martinez and McCoy come around the other corner, and Martinez fires all six rounds in his revolver. At the same time, McCoy steps over him, aims his shotgun at the white headband. I remember him vividly saying, all I saw was the white headband. After that shot, the sniper just kind of slid. He was in a sitting position, and he just kind of slid prone on the deck up there.
At that time, my gun was empty. I dropped my gun. I reached back, got the shotgun from McCoy, and went and shot him point blank one more time because he still had that carbine on his right hand, and there was still movement. He might have been dead, but he's still movement, you know? And so I fired one more time, and that was it.
This is Neil Spouse with a bulletin from the KTBC radio newsroom. The sniper is dead. The sniper, apparently tentatively identified as Charles J. Whitman, 25 years old, from Deedsville, is dead.
I broadcast the fact that the sniper was killed and gave his name. And I put that information on the air. It was amazing. The people who were listening to radio, how powerful the radio medium was and is, they flooded the South Mall. Hundreds and hundreds of people. They filled that entire South Mall where Claire Wilson was hauled to safety after being shot in her womb and killing her baby and her boyfriend right there. They were standing out there walking around that area. They were like zombies. Nobody said. They didn't say anything. It was a disbelief. It was quiet after all the chaos. All these people were out there. And you didn't hear mumble, or, hey, what's going on? It was quiet.
You couldn't walk across the mall area, you know, below the tower without looking up and feeling, okay, is this all right? You know, you had to go about your business. I mean, you had to get back to work. You know, they didn't just stop classes. I mean, you went on to school.
That day, August 1st of 1966, was on a Monday. And they closed school on Tuesday to clean up the blood, and UT reopened on Wednesday.
It was paralyzing because you'd walk along campus and there'd be pock marks in the granite and pock marks in part, you know, where you'd missed a shot. You know, there was still refuse, maybe police markings or something like that. And, of course, you couldn't help but look up.
You could see the inscription on the south side of the main building: "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And to me, One of the truths I discovered that day are there is monsters that live among us. There are people... there are people that think unthinkable thoughts and do unthinkable things. And they're out there. There's more good than bad, but there are monsters that walk among us.
Back then, you didn't think about as much as you do now about feelings and reactions to things. So I don't think people thought about that. You know, there could be some emotional reactions to what had happened, and you just kind of went on and didn't always deal with those feelings.
Well, I felt very, very thankful that my life had been spared. But I also felt guilty. And I didn't know why. But it made me determined not to waste my life. That if I was going to be spared, that I had to be worth something. I just didn't want to disappoint God. I didn't want him to think that I threw away a chance or that I took it lightly, because I didn't. A lot of people got shot that day. A lot of people died that day. Not by any fault of theirs, not because of anything they did other than go to class or go visit the tower on their vacation. And I don't know why them and not me.
In the mid-60s, we didn't really have a language for trauma. It wasn't really understood as it is now. There was no emergency rescue involved. There was no notion about the importance of traumatic grieving and memory. But you start realizing that it was more of an active kind of suppression.
It is probably true that the university was in a state of denial. It is certainly true the university didn't want to talk about this. Who would? I mean, this was the first time an individual committed mass murder in public, killing people he didn't even know. And we were not used to this. It was the first school shooting, as we think of it today. So this defined our ideas of what mass murder is in public. And because of that, it didn't come to us with instructions.
So you just dealt with things. You just dealt with what you dealt with. And it has much more of an impact on me now that I'm older than it did at the time.
I think at the time we figured it was a one-off, a random event that would never occur again. We were unfortunately very wrong there.
I knew that it was sort of a turning point, not just for me, but certainly for my generation, I think, where we no longer felt like everything was just hunky-dory and safe. We'd already felt, because of Vietnam, because the assassination of John Kennedy, you know, that sort of shook our world, all of that life was not as protected and as safe and so forth as we'd thought.
It was a moment in which sort of our innocence was lost.
I'm a different person as a result of those horrible things having happened. I see things a little differently, and, you know, it brings a hurt into your body that never really quite goes away.
I'm getting better when I talk about it. It was a terrible day, but I think, like combat soldiers, everybody has a story that was here then. And I guess that's my story. I think that's it. Hopefully I'm all cried out.
Deep down, we know we are far from being all cried out. If it all began on a summer day, a once upon a time in Austin, Texas, then where does it end? 50 years on, with an even greater sense of urgency. We're still looking for answers, and at the same time, it keeps getting harder to add it all together. 5 at a peaceful demonstration, 9 in a church, 10 at a community college, 13 at an army base, 24 at a cafeteria, 26 in an elementary school, 33 on a rural university campus, 50 at a nightclub, and pages upon pages of others until it feels impossible to keep count. We resort to a shorthand of place names: Luby's, San Bernardino, Dallas, the Tower. After 5 decades of looking up at that clock on the University of Texas campus and asking why, the persistence of memory points to what may be a more pressing question. How? How did we fail to listen to each other then? How do we translate all these recollections into a memory of meaning today? How do we imagine our tomorrows? How do we begin to make a difference? There are stories still untold from that August 1st, 1966. So far, nearly 100 survivors have contributed to this oral history, a living history of the Texas Tower shooting. Many of these stories never before shared until now. You can explore those stories, learn more of the history of this event and its legacy, including photos, videos, and archival documents, at towerhistory.org. Texas Standards Out of the Blue was made possible by a grant from the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History, where our interviews will be permanently archived. Our executive producers were Emily Donahue and Laura Rice, with production help from Ann Lifesti, Lucia Benavides, Joy Diaz, and Rhonda Fanning. Out of the Blue is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. From the studios of the Texas Standard in Austin, I'm David Brown.